Well, good morning again. Glad you're here. Pastor Tim is on vacation. I'm not sure if he's up in Buffalo getting pounded by the snow. But anyway, so you're stuck with me today. If you don't know who I am, I'm the associate pastor here. My name's Bill Stepp. We're glad that you have joined us today. It's kind of hard to believe it is December already. This year's flown by. But at the end of this month, on December 29th, it's going to be the 58th anniversary of a film with this guy in it, Clint Eastwood. From that picture, many of you may recognize the movie. It was called The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. I think I've seen parts of it, but the plot is that there's three guys, a good guy, a bad guy, and an ugly guy, and their lives are kind of intertwined as they're searching for this lost gold, and each one lives up to kind of the title that their character was given. If you've never seen the movie, it's okay. It has no bearing on today's sermon, that it's not going to affect it, but we're going to look at actually a similar narrative in the Bible, that there's three people and their lives are intertwined, and they kind of live up to the characters or the titles that they're given. And for copyright purposes, I've renamed this sermon to The Good, the Fool, and the Ugly. And so we're going to be in the Old Testament today in 1 Samuel chapter 25. So go ahead and turn to 1 Samuel chapter 25 if you have a Bible. And while you're turning there, I'm just going to give a brief background of what's already happened in 1 Samuel, kind of catch us up to speed as we get into chapter 25. So back in chapter 10, Saul is anointed as the king. However, after a couple times of disobeying God, God then rejected Saul as the king. We get into chapter 16, and Samuel the prophet then comes and anoints David to be the next king after Saul. In chapter 17, David defeats Goliath. And then in chapter 18, Saul gets really jealous of him and tries to kill him. And then for chapters 19 to chapter 25, Saul is chasing after David and trying to kill him. I'm not sure exactly, the timeline's not perfect in the Bible, but many commentaries think at chapter 25, David has been on the run for about 4 to 5 years now, with Saul having to try to kill David about 8 different times. So David's got a lot going on in his life. And as we get into chapter 25, in verse 1, we find then that Samuel the prophet, who's David's friend and his mentor, has died. And so the person that David had run to earlier in 1 Samuel when Saul was chasing him, he dies. And so that kind of sets the stage. I'm kind of exhausted just like reading through the list of things, you know, and maybe you're feeling exhausted, like things are coming at you. And so maybe you can relate to David today. But all that is setting the stage as we get into this narrative in chapter 25. And we're going to, right off the bat, be introduced to the characters that we're going to see throughout this narrative. And so in chapter 25, we are going to end up reading all 44 verses today. It's not a two-parter, so sorry, didn't save you on that one. But anyway, we'll jump around a little bit, but follow along as I read. So in 1 Samuel chapter 25, starting in verse 1, says, "Now Samuel died, and all Israel assembled and mourned for him, and they buried him in the house at Ramah. Then David rose and went down to the wilderness of Paran, and there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. He was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now the name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife Abigail. The woman was discerning and beautiful." And unfortunately, the Bible doesn't stop there. It goes on then to tell us that Nabal, the man, was harsh and badly behaved. He was a Calebite. And so right off the bat, we get our three characters that we're going to see. First is David, kind of got some of his backstory already. And then we've got Nabal. He's a rich businessman, 3,000 sheep, 1,000 goats. But unfortunately, he's harsh and badly behaved. And I'm not sure if he was given this name at birth or if it was just kind of a nickname he picked up over time. But the word Nabal actually means fool. So we'll see him being our fool today throughout this narrative. And then the last one, our last character, is Abigail. And she is discerning or wise and beautiful. We could go into a whole sermon about how those two, opposites attract, it seems, but that's a different day. But if you're curious, here's a map. So this is a satellite view of the Middle East. At the top there is Jerusalem. That's really washed out, but it actually says Jerusalem. And then where we're talking about today is Maon down south. So a little bit easier to see map is Maon's down south, and the pin just above it is Carmel. So that's where Nabal's from. A man from Maon has a business in Carmel. And back in 1 Samuel 23, we're actually told that David and his men went to the wilderness of Maon. So that's that open area off to the right of Carmel. And then it continues and says that he went up from there and lived in the strongholds of En-Gedi, which is on the far right area. And so he was in the wilderness, Maon, he was in En-Gedi, and then our Bible passage opens up today, says that he moved to the wilderness of Paran. Some people think that Paran and Maon are the same, or he may have just moved further south. Either way, David is out in the wilderness at this time with his men. And so we're going to continue and see what we can learn from this. So our first thing that we're going to see is the fool in our narrative here is Nabal, and he's going to return David's good with evil. So we're going to look at verse 4 to learn about Nabal. So again, 1 Samuel 25 in verse 4 says, David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. So David sent 10 young men, and David said to the young men, go up to Carmel and go to Nabal and greet him in my name. And thus you shall greet him. Peace be to you, and peace be to your house, and peace be to all that you have. I hear that you have shears. Now your shepherds have been with us, and we did them no harm, and they missed nothing all the time there in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. Please give whatever you have at hand to your servants and to your son David. This is actually a pretty reasonable request. In that wilderness, there's a lot of Philistine raiders. They could have come in and they could have wiped out Nabal's shepherds. They could have taken the whole flock and left Nabal with absolutely nothing. And not to mention, David had about 600 men with him, and they were hungry in the wilderness. So they very easily could have taken and had a lamb feast as well. And so instead, what they did was they protected Nabal's flock. Which is kind of interesting. David was actually a shepherd growing up, so he knew how to do that, and now he's a warrior. And so they did a good thing for Nabal, and then he sent this small delegation, 10 young men, and it three times he says, peace be with you, like he's being polite about it. Hey, peace be with you, and here's what happened. And he didn't go with his whole army. He didn't go in person to intimidate. It was just this small delegation of people that he sent. So he's kind of doing it in the right way. And it's sheep shearing time, which you have to kind of understand. And we could look at other places, but sheep shearing time is when you count your money. So he's shearing the sheep, and that's actually when you're making your money, is when you're shearing the sheep. And so every sheep he shears, you know, there's another one. And it's a time of festivity, a time of abundance. In the evenings, the shearers would all come in and they would all kind of party. Kind of like our Thanksgiving, right? We just celebrated that the other day, and many of us may have had seconds, thirds, and still leftovers. And so sheep shearing time was this time of abundance where they would help anybody in need. They would just share with those who needed it. And so David came at the right time and made a polite request, and he didn't even demand anything. He said, hey, whatever you think we earned. Which is kind of interesting. I remember when I was growing up, in the fall, I would rake leaves, try and make a couple extra dollars. But I remember my parents telling me I could not set a price. I had to just tell the people, hey, whatever you think I earn, that's what you pay me. And so it actually made me work harder because they were looking at my work and judging me and paying me based off of that. Sometimes I'd get more than I expected. Other times, not so much, but it was a polite way of just kind of leaving it up to them. And so there's no official agreement. David didn't have anything in writing with Nabal, But this was a customary thing for people to do. He would protect it. He's doing something good. And so Nabal, in the abundance, would actually return their good services at the time of shearing. And so we see in verse 9, it continues, and it says that when David's young men came, they said all this to Nabal in the name of David, and then they waited. That word waited, or some translations say rested, actually has this idea of a long rest. Kids these days would say that they're left on read. So it's when they send a message and someone reads it, but they didn't respond. They're left on read. And it has this idea of feeling ignored. And so Nabal's left him on read. He's heard the message, and now they're sitting there waiting for him. And then we get his response down in verses 10 and 11. It says, "And Nabal answered David's servants, 'Who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants these days who are breaking away from their masters. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shears and give it to men who come from I do not know where?'" And if we jump down to verses 14, we see a little bit more about this interaction. It says, "But one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, 'Behold, David sent messengers out of the wilderness to greet our master, and he railed at them. Yet the men were very good to us, and we suffered no harm. We did not miss anything when we were in the fields, as long as we went with them. They were a wall to us both by night and by day, all the while we were with them keeping the sheep. Now therefore, know this and consider what you should do, for harm is determined against our master and against all his house, and he is such a worthless man that one cannot speak to him.'" And so again, David's making this response. It's a reasonable response. It's at the proper time. He's doing it in a polite way. The servants confirmed that they actually were speaking the truth. They had helped him out in the wilderness. So it's not like David was lying. But unfortunately, Nabal was returning David's good with evil. In the ESV, it said railed at them. The Greek word actually means to scream or to shriek. Some other translations put it that he tore into them with insults, or he hurled insults at them. And so David, or Nabal, actually knew who David was. Earlier in 1 Samuel, it says that out of all the towns of Israel, people were coming out cheering for David and the many men that he had killed versus Saul's men. And so Nabal knew. He just didn't want to share his abundance. And instead, he insulted David. His me monster came out, as Pastor Tim would say. If you read through those couple verses, seven different times in Nabal's response, he says, "I or my. Am I going to give up my stuff for someone? I don't know who you are." And right, and so he's more focused. He's kind of proud of his accomplishments and his wealth. He's unwilling to share. And in Proverbs, we see this idea of, I'm going to stop and pray. There's a lady just taken out, and it looks like we may be calling an ambulance. So I'm just going to pray real quick. Lord, I pray for whatever's going on. I don't know exactly what it is. You do. You know everything. And we rest in your hands, knowing that you are the God in control, Lord. I just pray for whoever was just taken out, Lord. I pray for the people who are helping her right now. I pray for the ambulances on the way. And I just pray for her family, Lord. I just, in this time of Thanksgiving, we just saddened to see this happening. I just pray that you would, even now, calm my nerves. Just help me to be able to continue preaching. Just help us to be able to focus on you, Lord. In your name we pray. Amen. Anyway, so Nabal has turned down David. We see in Proverbs this idea. It says, "The wealth of the rich is their fortified city. They imagine it a wall too high to scale." And so he's imagining what he has is this wall protecting him. And in verse 23, it goes on to say that the poor plead for mercy, but the rich answer harshly. It's kind of interesting to think, how often are we like Nabal. Instead of generously giving the abundance that God has provided us, we hold on to it and kind of be stingy with it, keeping it all for ourselves. It's really interesting. If Nabal had said, sure, I got plenty, take it, I don't think this would be in the Bible. We wouldn't know about Nabal. We wouldn't know about this interaction, right? And so it's just interesting. But anyway, as we're looking at the good, the fool, the ugly, Nabal's being a fool, as his name implies. He's returning David's good with evil. And in verse 17, we read that the servant had told Abigail to consider what she would do because harm was determined against their master. And that's exactly what was happening. Things were getting ugly at this point. And while ugly can refer to this repulsive look, it also means to involve violence or other unpleasantness. Maybe politics came up at your Thanksgiving dinner, and I had this written before we had Thanksgiving, but maybe politics came up and things started getting ugly in your discussion. But that's exactly what's going on here. Nabal threw insults at David, and David was insulted. So things were starting to get ugly, and that's where we see this next character coming in, the ugly. That's David. And as he started off doing good, now in response to Nabal's evil, he's going to return evil with evil. And we see that in verse 12. So David's men had come back. In verse 12 it says, so David's young men turned away and came back and told him all this. And David said to his men, every man strap on his sword. And every man of them strapped on his sword. David also strapped on his sword. And about 400 men went up after David, while 200 remained with the baggage. And so in a Western movie, Clint Eastwood might say something like, mount up, let's ride. It's basically what David's saying. He says, strap on your swords. What's really interesting is it says that David also strapped on his sword. Might seem like a really insignificant detail, but David is strapping on a sword that initially belonged to Goliath. If we look back in 1 Samuel 17, it says David defeated Goliath with a sling and a stone, right? And then David ran and stood over the Philistine and took Goliath's sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. And then in chapter 21, while he's on the run from Saul, they stop in Nob, and it says, David said to Ahimelech, then have you not here a spear or a sword at hand? For I have brought neither my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's business required haste. And the priest said, the sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you struck down in the valley of Elah, behold, it is here, wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you will take that, take it, for there is none but that here. And David said, there is none like that. Give it to me. And so while he's on the run, he gets Goliath's sword, and that's what he's strapping on right now. And instead of strapping it on and thinking, man, God gave me the victory over Goliath, God is in control, he's strapping it on saying, I'm going to go and kill Nabal, right? And just think about, some of us have Bible verse reminders around our house, maybe other things that help remind us of God's faithfulness. But it's so often when we're exhausted and stressed, and we looked at everything going on in David's life, he's exhausted, he's stressed, and now he's just overlooking God's faithfulness. All those reminders, he wasn't focused on them. And I think a lot of times we lose our focus for the same reason that David did, right? And instead of being focused on God's faithfulness, what we see is that he's focused on himself. In verse 21, as they're riding to meet Nabal, he's pondering over and over in his mind. And I know I do that. I stew on the problem. And it actually then gets worse because I start adding in other things, you know, but he's just stewing on it. And so in verse 21, it says, now David had said, surely in vain have I guarded all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him. And he returned me evil for good. God do so to the enemies of David and more also, if by morning I leave so much as one male of all who belong to him. And so as David's stewing over that, he's got the facts right. Nabal did return him evil for good. But the problem is that David's heart was in the wrong place. He's having a pity party for himself. He's not reminding himself of God's faithfulness. He's not reminding himself of how God had been in control and conquered in the past. And he's just sitting there thinking through all this. And it's really interesting in this narrative, we get to verse 22, and that's the first time that God is mentioned. 22 verses looking at it, and we see God's name finally mentioned. And it's not David going and getting counsel from God. He's not praying and saying, God, what do you want me to do in this situation? It's actually David calling down a curse on himself. He's writing and he says, if I don't annihilate Nabal, God do to me the same I'm going to do to him. Right? And so he's not really thinking right now. He's just focused on himself, what he thought he deserved, and he's off to annihilate Nabal. And again, it's kind of interesting. I say interesting a lot. Cool, whatever. Anyway, in 1 Samuel, these stories are all intertwined because David had just had a very similar interaction. Saul's been chasing him for 4 or 5 years, trying to kill him. Now we have Nabal who just insults him, and he's actually acting differently. If you want to flip back one chapter to chapter 24, we could see this interaction where David has an opportunity to return to Saul what he's been getting, right? He's on the run from Saul. Saul's tried several times. Right now, David is in En Gedi, and Saul gets word that that's where David's at, and he's going to get him. And the one thing that they don't show in the movies is the bathroom breaks. You think about the good, the bad, and the ugly. They ride all over the wilderness for days on end, and no one ever stops to go. If you're on a road trip, or, you know, in real life, that's not the case. And here we have Saul. They're on a road trip to go get David, and he's got to stop. And so they pull over at the nearest rest stop, and that just so happens to be where David is hiding at. And in chapter 24, verse 3, it says, there it is. And he came to the sheepfolds by way where there was a cave, and Saul went in to relieve himself. Now David and his men were sitting in the innermost parts of the cave, and the men of David said to him, here is the day of which the Lord said to you, behold, I will give your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as it shall seem good to you. Then David arose and stealthily cut off a corner of Saul's robe, and afterward David's heart struck him, because he had cut off a corner of Saul's robe. He said to his men, the Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to put out my hand against him, seeing he is the Lord's anointed. So David persuaded his men with these words and did not permit them to attack Saul. And Saul rose up and left the cave and went on his way. Afterward, David also arose and went out of the cave and called after Saul. And they have a little conversation. And then if we jump down to verse 17 in chapter 4 there, Saul said to David, you are more righteous than I, for you have repaid me good, whereas I have repaid you evil. And so it's a similar situation. Saul had repaid evil to David, and David in turn repays him good back, whereas Nabal returns evil to David, and David's like, all right, I'm going to go return you evil. And it's kind of interesting to think of why Saul treated him differently. Why David treated Saul differently than Nabal. But it's even more interesting, why do we treat people differently? Why do I treat one person with good even though they're showing me evil, and someone else I return evil for their evil? And we could see, I think, two reasons as we look at those kind of comparative narratives for why David was treating them differently. I think the first being that he was feeling kind of superior to Nabal. If we look in chapter 4 at that interaction with Saul, David called Saul his lord, which is a term for master or superior. He is looking at Saul as someone who is his superior, whereas in his ranting in chapter 25, he looks at Nabal and he calls him this fellow. He's just this fellow, right? And so he's treating Saul, who's his superior one way, and Nabal, who he sees as an inferior, a different way. Another thing that kind of his view was, he wasn't really looking at Nabal in light of God. Again, in chapter 24, when he's talking about Saul, he calls him the Lord's anointed. He's looking at Saul as, who is Saul in light of God? He's the Lord's anointed. And again, at Nabal, he's like, it's an annoyance. It's someone in my way instead of someone loved by God. He was right. Nabal's the one that insulted him. He was going to take out his whole family, right? And so he wasn't viewing them in light of who they were in God's eyes. And so I challenge us kind of as we think about how does this apply to our lives. Do we treat our superiors differently than people we view as inferior to us? Do we treat other Christians differently than we treat non-Christians? Are we viewing them differently in light of who God is? Right? Even the unsaved people around us are still precious in God's eyes. And so, I would just kind of think about that. The golden rule in Matthew 7, as you wish that others would do to you, do so to them. It doesn't say the people you like, other Christians, right? The golden rule is for everyone. Our superiors, our inferiors, other political parties. The only difference between us, if you're saved, between a Christian and a non-Christian is God's grace. We didn't do anything to earn it. They're still created in his sight and still loved by God. And so we should still love them the same way. And so as we get back into chapter 25, into our narrative, David strapped on his sword, 400 men are going to go return evil for evil. And that's definitely not a biblical principle. As Pastor Tim would say, someone asked me if I got a verse for that. Yes, I knew you were going to ask that. So I got a couple verses, actually. So here's some verses about returning evil. In Proverbs, it says, do not say, I will repay evil. Wait for the Lord, and he will deliver you. Again, in Proverbs, it says, do not say, I will do to him as he has done to me. I will pay the man back for what he has done. In Romans, it says, repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourself, but leave it to the wrath of God, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. And it continues to say, to the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink, for by doing so, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Another one in the New Testament, 1 Thessalonians says, see that no one repays evil for evil, but always seek to do good to one another and to everyone. Jesus himself said in Matthew 5, you heard that it is said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist one who is evil, but if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And the idea of that slapping on the right cheek is not someone punches you or hits you with a baseball bat. It actually has the connotation, the idea of if someone insults you, turn your other cheek, walk away. And so, again, this is a biblical principle. There's many more I could have pulled out there. But in our narrative, the good, the fool, and the ugly, David is getting ugly. He's returning Nabal's evil for evil. And ultimately, his plan here is, and I know I've said it many times, like, I'm going to get even with that person. David's idea is, I'm going to get even with Nabal. And here's the problem with that. Another proverb, it says, answer not a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him yourself. So David is anointed to be the next king of Israel, and Nabal's down here as a fool, and David's like, I'm going to get even with him. Well, when you get even with someone, you bring yourself to their level. David's about to become the fool. Right? And so I would just kind of encourage us when those words come out of our mouth, I'm going to get even. Well, maybe we don't want to be brought down to their level. And so this is where our last character comes in. We've got Nabal the fool, David the ugly, and now we've got Abigail the good. Once Abigail's made aware of the situation, what she ends up doing is she returns David's evil with good. We'll see this in verse 18. So in verse 18, it says, then Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves and 2 skins of wine and 5 sheep already prepared and 5 shays of parched grain and 100 clusters of raisins and 200 cakes of figs and laid them on donkeys. And she said to her young men, go on before me. Behold, I come after you. But she did not tell her husband, Nabal. Did you catch the abundance that Abigail got? Like, she made haste and she collected this very quickly. It didn't seem like it was over a couple day period. 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, or some translations say bottles. And my mind automatically goes to bottles of wine in our store. But I was doing some research. It said that the skins of wine could hold as much as 6 gallons each. It's a lot of wine. Not one of those tiny bottles. Anyway, they also had 5 sheep that were already prepared, 5 shays or about 40 pounds of grain, 100 clusters of raisins, 200 cakes of fig, cakes of figs. I mean, that's a lot of food. If we had that here, we'd be pretty happy. That's an abundance. And if we skip down further to verse 36, after Abigail gets back from her mission, it says, and Abigail came to Nabal, and behold, he was holding a feast in his house, like the feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. Abigail took all that food, and Nabal didn't notice any of it missing. He still had a feast like a king. He still got drunk. It wasn't a problem. Again, if he had just said, been like, oh, here, David, take some of this, be happy, we wouldn't see this in the Bible at all. But Abigail knew that old proverb that the way to a man's heart is through his stomach. So she gathered all the food, she took it, she met David, and then we're going to pick up in verse 23 and see their interaction when she meets with him. It says, when Abigail saw David, she hurried and got down from the donkey and fell before David on her face and bowed to the ground. She fell at his feet and said, on me alone, my Lord, be the guilt. Please let your servant speak in your ears and hear the words of your servant. Let not my Lord regard this worthless fellow, Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your servant, did not see the young man of my Lord whom you sent. Now then, my Lord, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, because the Lord has restrained you from blood guilt and from saving with your own hand, now let your enemies and those who seek to do evil to my Lord be as Nabal. And now let this present that your servant has brought to my Lord be given to the young men who follow my Lord. Please forgive the trespass of your servant, for the Lord will certainly make my Lord a sure house, because my Lord is fighting the battles of the Lord, and evil shall not be found in you as long as you live. If men rise up to pursue you and to seek your life, the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living, in the care of the Lord your God. In the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the hollow of a sling. And when the Lord has done to my Lord according to all that the good that has spoken concerning you and has appointed you prince over Israel, my Lord shall have no cause for grief or pangs of conscience, for having shed blood without cause for my Lord, working salvation himself. And when the Lord has dealt with my servant, then remember your servant. And so she comes and she has this interaction. She's returning David's evil with good. She got all the food, she went, and then in verse 23, when they meet up, she falls on her face before David. And in those 8 verses that we read, she called David 14 different times, my Lord. And she called herself his servant 6 different times. She's humbled herself before David. And then she even takes the blame on herself. She says, on me alone, my Lord, be the guilt. It wasn't her fault. She had nothing to do with it. She didn't even know the people showed up. But she says, on me alone, be the guilt. I'm going to humble myself. And then she continues speaking truth into David's life. Again, in the first 22 verses, we see God's name once. And it's David saying, hey, if I fail, God, do it to me what I was going to do. In these 8 verses I just read, Abigail refers to the Lord or God 8 times. What she's doing is she's helping David to take his focus off his worldly problems and bring them back on God. She's reminding him of God's past faithfulness. She's reminding him that even in his current situation, God is in control, right? She's reminding him that he's anointed, and ultimately, if he goes through with this, he'd be sinning against God. So she's trying to bring David's focus back on God. In his book, Better Decisions, Fewer Regrets, Anley Stanley wrote this. He wrote, "You like to be the hero in your own story. We all want that. And going forward, you can have that. But it'll require you to stop mid-decision and ask, what story do I want to tell? When this crisis, this opportunity, this temptation is in the rearview mirror, when it's reduced to a story I tell, what story do I want to tell? Which of the available options do you want as part of your story?" He goes on to say, "Every decision you make becomes part of the story of your life. Every relational, financial, and professional decision and the outcomes of those decisions become permanent parts of your story. We've all lived long enough to have a few chapters we wish we could erase. No doubt you have a few stories you wish you could rewrite. We all do. We call it regret. But chances are, the decisions that led to your greatest regrets could have been avoided if you had paused to ask yourself, what story do I want to tell? From here on out, write a story worth telling. Write a story you're proud to tell. If you're in the middle of making a decision right now, stop and ask yourself, of the available options, which one do I want as a permanent part of my story?" So that's exactly what Abigail's saying. She's saying, hey, what part do you want this to be in your permanent story? And we see how David responds to that. She's trying to bring his focus back onto God. And in verse 32, we see his response to her. It says, "And David said to Abigail, blessed be the Lord." So that's the first time he's actually focused on God in this narrative. "The God of Israel who sent you this day to me, blessed be your discretion and blessed be you who have kept me this day from blood guilt and from working salvation with my own hand. For as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel lives, who has restrained me from hurting you, unless you had hurried and come to meet me, truly by morning there had not been left to Nabal so much as one male. Then David received from her what she had brought to him and said to her, go up in peace to your house. See, I have obeyed your voice and I have granted your petition." And so Abigail helps David to stop focusing on his worldly problems and to bring his focus back onto God. And she helps him to really think about, again, as Andy Stanley had said, what part of this story do you want to tell? You don't want this senseless act of murder to be part of your permanent story. And I don't have time to dig into this right now, but I do want to point out that although Abigail did a really good thing and she saved a lot of people, she was not perfect. As we look at this narrative, she went behind her husband's back. She took things that he had not allowed. She was then talking down to David, right? And so I just want us to, in the rest of the Bible, it doesn't talk about Abigail, but I don't want us to, some of my commentaries put her on this really high pedestal. Look how great and amazing Abigail is. But we have to remember that she was not perfect, right? And that'll come into play here in a minute. But as we finish our narrative, I told you we were going to read all of it. So picking up in verse 36 and finishing it out. It says, "And Abigail came to Nabal. Behold, he was holding a feast in his house, like the feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. So she told him nothing at all until the morning light. In the morning, when the wine had gone out of Nabal, his wife told him these things, and his heart died within him, and he became a stone. And about 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, blessed be the Lord, who has avenged the insult I received at the hand of Nabal, and has kept back his servant from wrongdoing. The Lord has returned the evil of Nabal on his own head. Then David sent and spoke to Abigail to take her as his wife. When the servants of David came to Abigail at Carmel, they said to her, David has sent us to you to take you to him as his wife. And she rose and bowed with her face to the ground and said, behold, your handmaid is a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord. And Abigail hurried and rose and mounted a donkey, and her 5 young women attended her. She followed the messengers of David and became his wife. In 1966, The Good, the Bad, the Ugly was released. Spoiler alert, in the end, the bad guy is killed, and then the good guy and the ugly guy actually ride off into the sunset with the treasures that they had been searching for. In our narrative here, the fool dies in the end, and David and Abigail ride off into the sunset. They're married, right? And so as we're looking at this narrative, we got Nabal. He's returned David's evil for evil. Nabal returned good with evil. David returned evil with evil. And then Abigail returned David's evil with good. And I think we can all kind of place ourselves into one of those. Maybe some days you're good. Maybe some days you're ugly. I know for me, and I'm ashamed to say it, just last week, things didn't go my way, and I got kind of ugly, and I was rude and mean to those around them. And so I think from each of them, we can kind of learn things for our daily application. And there's a lot more that we can dig into and see exactly kind of how Abigail redirected David's focus onto God, different ways that we can help others redirect our focus onto God. But there's a bigger picture going on here. Right? There's a bigger narrative happening that we can't overmiss. Like Nabal, we've all acted like fools in the way that we've responded to God. In Psalm 14, it says, "The fool says in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They do abominable deeds. There is none who does good." And even when we think we're good or do good deeds, like Abigail, we are not perfect. Romans 3:23 says that we've all sinned. We all fall short of the glory of God. So no matter how much good we do, we've fallen short of the glory of God. And David, he was upset. He didn't get what he deserved. Quite honestly, what we all deserve because we fall short of the glory of God is we all deserve. Romans 6:23 says that the wages or the punishment, the payment of sin is death. That's what we deserve. But the really cool thing is that God is not like David. David got insulted once, and he just flew off the handle and said, "We're going to go destroy them." If we look at Psalm 145, it tells us that the Lord is gracious and merciful, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. The Lord is good to all, and his mercy is over all that he has made. So here's the bigger idea, the bigger narrative that we can't overlook. Abigail did a good thing, and she went and intervened on Nabal's behalf. And she saved his life. For us, we are the fools. And because of our sin, we are separated from God. We can't have a relationship with him. But Jesus Christ, like Abigail, he's the creator of the universe. He humbled himself, and he came to the earth to intervene on our behalf. Philippians 2 tells us that, it says, "Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who though he was in the form of God..." So he's the creator of the universe. He was in heaven. It says he didn't count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. And being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. So again, like Abigail, he came and he humbled himself and he took the blame. He was perfect. Jesus Christ is the only perfect one to have walked this earth. And yet he said, "On me, my Lord, be the blame. Let me take the punishment. Let me take the blame." And so Jesus died on the cross. And the Bible tells us all we have to do is put our faith in that, to believe that he died and rose again, and we can be reconciled. We can be brought back to God and have a relationship with him. If you've not done that, today could be the day. It's as simple as putting your faith in Jesus, believing that he died on your behalf to save you from the wrath of God. And so as we conclude, I don't want us to overlook the everyday application that this narrative has, right? We shouldn't try to get even with other people. We shouldn't be returning evil for evil. Instead, we should be treating everyone with good because that's what Jesus did for us. So in return, we show love to others. But I definitely want us not to forget the overall picture of this narrative as we leave today. As we think about, and we're right in between two seasons, but as we conclude our Thanksgiving season, I really hope that we give thanks to God, to Jesus, for coming and dying on our behalf so that we can be reconciled to God and have eternal life. And as we move into the Christmas season, I really hope that we don't forget the real reason that Jesus came down. It's very easy to lose focus and look at our worldly things going on. But I really hope as we move into this Christmas season, we remember that Jesus Christ came down, humbled himself in the form of a man to eventually die on the cross on our behalf so we can have a relationship. So with that, I'm going to close this in prayer. Lord, I just thank you for this morning. Just thank you for this time that we can spend in your word. I just thank you that all throughout the Bible is pictures of Jesus Christ. Even when they don't seem there, it all points to you. We just thank you that Jesus came and died on our behalf, that we can have a relationship. Lord, as we leave today, I pray that you would just help us to think about these different characters and how they acted. Nabal being a fool, David being ugly, Abigail being good. Lord, I just pray that you would help us to just desire to live godly lives, not so that we can have a relationship, but because you already died for us. I pray that out of the love that you showed us, we would show love to others. I pray that if anyone's in the middle of a decision today, Lord, that you would help them to remove their focus on their worldly situations and to focus on you, Lord. So I pray as we leave today that you would just be with us, watch over us, just help us to give all honor and glory to you. In your name we pray. Amen.